All right. This week's parashat is Chaya Sarah and the life of Sarah. And my intention was to ignore that completely whenever I started the lesson plan for this week because it didn't match with my program. And about a day ago, we do a parashat study at my office in the mornings, and it hit me that. And so everything, it's different. So this is first run. You're going to get raw Sam instead of rehearsed Sam, which is, I don't know which is better, probably neither. Because this isn't about the life of Sarah. What I learned from reading this parashat when we were in our study class, what was it, John? This is a crash course in Middle Eastern business, this whole parashat. In fact, when I went through the thing and tried to separate it out, it was a crash course in Middle Eastern. How do you do business in the Middle East? In fact, if for no other reason, it's actually how do you do godly business, because it's in the Bible, and it's not vilified for how these transactions take place. So when I went through it, I realized that it impacts, or at least spoke to what the topics were that I was actually going to cover. Because it's all about business, as it turns out. So let's see if that's true. Genesis 25, the parashat starts in Genesis 23. And I've asked my lovely wife to read, because I know there's a lot of material to cover today. So she's going to help me out by reading the scripture portions so that we can move this thing along quickly, because I'm hoping I did not set a timer. I probably should have. You got it? All right, just go, because this could take a while. All right, so let's get started. Chapter 23.
And Sarah died at Kiriath Arba, that is Hebron, in the land of Canaan. And Abram went in to mourn for Sarah and to weep for her. And Abraham rose up from before his dead and said to the Hittites, I am a sojourner and foreigner among you. Give me property among you for a burying place, that I may bury my dead out of my sight. The Hittites answered Abraham, Hear us, my lord, you are a prince of Elohim among us. Bury your dead in the choicest of our tombs. None of us will withhold it from you, his tomb, to hinder you from burying your dead. Abraham rose and bowed to the Hittites, the people of the land, and he said to them, If you're willing that I should bury my dead out of my sight, hear me and entreat me for me, Ephron, the son of Zohar, that he may give me the cave of Machpelah, which he owns. It is at the end of his field. For the full price, let him give it to me in your presence as property for a burying place. Now Ephron was sitting among the Hittites, and Ephron the Hittite answered Abraham in the hearing of the Hittites, all of whom went in at the gate of his city. No, my lord, hear me. I give you the field, and I give you the cave that is in it. In the sight of the sons of my people, I give it to you. Bury your dead. Then Abraham bowed down before the people of the land, and he said to Ephron in the hearing of the people of the land, But if you will, hear me, I give the price of the field. Accept it from me, that I may bury my dead there. Ephron answered Abraham, My lord, listen to me, a price of land worth 400 shekels of silver? What is that between you and me? Bury your dead. Abraham listened to Ephron. And Abraham weighed out for Ephron the silver that he had named in the hearing of the Hittites, 400 shekels of silver according to the weights current among the merchants. So the field of Ephron at Machpelah, which was to the east of Mamre, the field with the cave that was in it, and all the trees that were in the field throughout this whole area was made over to Abraham as a possession in the presence of the Hittites, before all who went in at the gate of his city. After this, Abraham buried Sarah his wife in the cave of the field of Machpelah, east of Mamre, that is Hebron, in the land of Canaan. The field and the cave that is in it were made over to Abraham as property for a burying place by the Hittites.
So let me paraphrase. If you want, I mean, one of the things I'd like for everybody in our congregation is to get excited when you read the scriptures. Pull up a chair and sit down and listen to the exchange here. This is hysterical, if you really get right down to it. This is hysterical. Abraham comes in, he's done with his mourning, he wants to bury his wife. I need a place to bury my wife. I need somebody give me some land so that I can bury my wife. And everybody goes, oh no, you're a prince of God. You're a prince of Elohim. Take whatever you want. Well, actually, I want that cave over there. It belongs to Hebron. And it's specific to its location because it's near Machpelah. Machpelah is near Hebron, which is near the Tree of Mamre. Now, Tree of Mamre has already come up about 3 or 4 times. Man, I'd love to do a teaching on that one. We know where this location is. This is a real spot, and we really know where it is.
To this day. To this day.
Yep.
Isaac and Rebekah are going to be buried there, and that Jacob and Leah are going to be buried there. And that place is going to be known as the cave of the forefathers. And to this day, you can go to Israel and visit this place.
And it's recorded in the Bible, and it's enumerated several times just in these verses here. It'll be covered again later, but it's enumerated in these verses here that Abraham purchased this property. And he owns it, and all of his descendants after him. So he's burying his family there because he owns it, and it's been designated as such. But here's the discussion when you pull your chair up. Take it for free. You know, you're a prince of God. Do whatever you want. You know, you're a wise man. Take it for free. Bury what you want. No. Now, this is where you know that Abraham's a Hebrew, but he's not a Jew, because he's the only guy in history of the Jews that ever negotiated the price up rather than down. He goes, no, I'm not going to take it for free. I'll pay you full price. Give you full price. What's the price? What's 400 shekels ago between you and me? Take it for free. Okay, it's 400 shekels. God, he's probably like, oy vey, man, that's just a cave. I mean, really, 400 shekels of gold, but all right, here's the 400 shekels of gold. All right, so transaction number one complete. Transaction number two, 24.
Now Abraham was old, well advanced in years, and Adonai had blessed Abram in all things. And Abraham said to his servant, the oldest of his household, who had charge of all that he had, put your hand under my thigh that I may make you swear to Adonai, the Elohim of heaven and Elohim of earth, that you will not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites among whom I dwell, but will go to my country and to my kindred and take a wife for my son Isaac. The servant said to him, perhaps the woman will not be willing to follow me to this land. Must I then take your son back to the land from which you came? And Abraham said to him, see to it that you do not take my son back there. Adonai, the Elohim of heaven, who took me from my father's house and from the land of my kindred, and who spoke to me and swore to me, to your offspring I will give this land, he will send his angel before you, and you shall take a wife for my son from there. But if the woman is not willing to follow you, then you will be free from this oath of mine, only you must not take my son back there. So the servant put his hand under the thigh of Abraham, his master, and swore to him concerning this matter.
So Abraham speaks to his servant. Again, pull your chair up and sit at this conversation and listen. If you noticed in the last conversation, all of the people were witness to this thing as ratification or a binding of the contract. All of the people are involved in the conversation. Nothing's done in secret. In fact, nothing in God's providence is done in secret. It's always a public, even your profession of faith is a public profession. And again, sit at the table, or in this conversation where the servant is asked to go get a son for his wife for his son, Isaac. And the servant's a little bit apprehensive. He goes, "Yeah, I might go out there and do that, but what if she doesn't come back? Then what? You know, am I in trouble? Do I take him back to this other location where you came from originally?" No. God will provide. You go do what I told you to do. And if she doesn't come back, you're free from the contract. You're free from the transaction. No harm will come to you. So he puts his hand under the thigh and agrees, and then he moves on. Now, we haven't skipped any verses yet. We're still working through transaction number 3. Verse 10.
Then the servant took 10 of his master's camels and departed, taking all sorts of choice gifts from his master. And he arose and he went to Mesopotamia, to the city of Nahor. And he made the camels kneel down outside the city by the well of water at the time of evening, the time when women go out to draw water. And he said, "O Adonai Elohim of my master Abraham, please grant me success today and show steadfast love to my master Abraham. Behold, I am standing by the spring of water, and the daughters of the men of the city are coming out to draw water. Let the young woman to whom I shall say, 'Please let down your jar that I may drink,' and who shall say, 'Drink, and I will water your camels,' let her be the one whom you have appointed for your servant Isaac."
Okay, who's the servant negotiating with now? God Almighty. That's pretty bold, but he sits down. He's negotiating with God Almighty. This is transaction number 3. God, if Abraham's found favor in your eyes, I'm really saying, if I found favor in your eyes, if I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing, let the girl that comes out. He doesn't even get done, and here she comes. Transaction number 4. Still haven't skipped any verses. Verse 15.
Before he had finished speaking, behold, Rebekah, who was born to Bethuel, the son of Milcah, the wife of Nahor, Abraham's brother, came out with her water jar on her shoulder. The young woman was very attractive in appearance, was a maiden whom no man had known. She went down to the spring and filled her jar and came up. Then the servant ran to meet her and said, "Please give me a little water to drink from your jar." And she said, "Drink, my lord." And she quickly let down her jar upon her hand and gave him a drink. When she had finished giving him a drink, she said, "I will draw water for your camels also until they have finished drinking." So she quickly emptied water into the trough and ran again to the well to draw water, and she drew for all his camels. And the man gazed at her in silence to learn whether Adonai had proposed his journey or not. When the camels had finished drinking, the man took a gold ring weighing a half shekel and 2 bracelets for her arms weighing 10 gold shekels.
So does everybody recognize the transaction that happened here? Rebecca comes down and she freely gives of herself, expecting nothing. But he says, "Can I have some water?" "Sure, drink some water. And oh, by the way, I'll water the camels too. 10 of them who can drink 20 gallons apiece." That's 1,200 pounds of water that she hoists out of a well and gives to these camels. Now, when she's done, what does he do? What does the servant do? He pays her. He puts a ring in her nose and puts gold bracelets on her arms. Now, he doesn't know if she's the girl, but he pays her anyway, and he has faith. Transaction number 5.
And said, "Please tell me whose daughter you are. Is there room in your father's house for us to spend the night?" And she said to him, "Oh, I'm the daughter of Bethuel, the son of Milcah, whom she bore to Nahor." She added, "We have plenty of both straw and fodder and room to spend the night."
Okay, so now she's telling him, again, she's still showing kindness, hesed. And she's still, even though she's been paid for her first duty, she's still acting as though she's still giving of herself freely and not actually requiring anything of him. She's offering a place to stay, food for the camels, and for them to lay down. So this is kind of the setup. We also, at this point, we meet Laban. Laban, we end up learning about later on, about his character. Early in this whole parashat, or in the previous parashat, we learned that everyone involved in the process, including the servant, they speak of how wonderful and how godly Abraham's character is. And when in this conversation before he leaves, he speaks about how wonderful and how godly and righteous Abraham is. But at this point, we're introduced into Laban. We're introduced to Laban and the family members. Apparently, Bethuel has died, has passed away, the patriarch of the family. And so she moves on and goes to her house, which is, he says, her mother's. She has says Rebekah's mother's house. And so that means that Laban must be the oldest son, and now he's assumed the patriarchal role in the home. Go ahead. Verse 23.
28, maybe.
Oh, 28, sorry.
Then the young woman ran and told her mother's household about these things. Rebekah had a brother whose name was Laban. Laban ran out towards the man to the spring. As soon as he saw the ring and the bracelets on his sister's arm and heard the words of Rebekah, his sister, thus the man spoke to me. He went to the man, and behold, he was standing by the camels at the spring. He said, "Oh, come in, O blessed of Adonai. Why do you stand outside? For I have prepared the house and the place for the camels."
Oh, man, I've done all this stuff for you because I saw you got some gold. He's got 10 camels laden with goodies, and you just gave my sister a whole bunch of really valuable stuff, and I like you. All right, go.
So 32. The man came to the house and unharnessed the camels and gave straw and fodder to the camels, and there was water to wash his feet.
Okay, so now the servant has servants with him because he can't handle 10 camels by himself. And Laban says, he comes to him and says, "Man, I got all this, you know, I got the place where you stay, all this stuff. Come on up." But who was the one that when they got to the house that unharnessed the camels, gave straw and fodder to the camels, and washed the feet of the men? Anyone? Wasn't Laban. Laban's in the house. He's got his feet kicked up. He's waiting for the goodies to show up. He's doing squat. It's the servant that's doing all the work. No hesed from Laban. So this is a smart servant. He's watching what's going on. Verse 32.
Then food was set before him to eat.
Sorry, yeah, 33. Go ahead. Yeah.
Then food was set before him to eat. But he said, "I will not eat until I have said what I have to say."
Okay, transaction number 6 starts. Here we go with the negotiation. Verse 34.
He said, "Speak on." So he said, "I am Abraham's servant, and Adonai has greatly blessed my master, and he has become great, and he has given him flocks and herds, silver and gold, male servants and female servants, camels and donkeys. And Sarah, my master's wife, bore a son to my master when she was old, and to him he has given all that he has."
So what does the servant tell Laban and the household about Abraham and Isaac? Does he tell them how righteous they are? How wonderful? They're rich! These people are rich! Because he's already established the character of the household. Rebekah she has hesed. But the rest of the family, bunch of greedy suckers. So he starts the negotiation knowing he sets them up. He really, really sets them up. So verse 37.
"My master made me swear, saying, 'You shall not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites in whose land I dwell, but you shall go to my father's house and to my clan and take a wife for my son.' I said to my master, 'Perhaps the woman will not follow me.' But he said to me, 'Adonai, before whom I've walked, will send his angel with you and prosper your way, and you shall take a wife for my son from my clan and from my father's house. Then you will be free from my oath when you come to my clan. And if they will not give her to you, you will be free from my oath.'"
Okay, now here's the sale. Go ahead, go ahead and skip down to verse 48.
Got it. Then I bowed my head and worshipped Adonai and blessed Adonai, the Elohim of my master Abraham, who had led me by the right way to take the daughter of my master's kinsman for his son. Now then, if you are going to show steadfast love and faithfulness to my master, tell me. And if not, tell me, that I might turn to the right hand or to the left. Then Laban and Bethuel answered and said, the thing has come from Adonai. We cannot speak to you good or bad. Behold, Rebekah is before you. Take her and go, and let her be the wife of your master's son, as Adonai has spoken. When Abraham's servant heard their words, he bowed himself to the earth before Adonai, and the servant brought out jewelry of silver and of gold and garments and gave them to Rebekah. And he also gave to her brother and to her mother costly ornaments.
So they unload the camels and give it to the family members and Rebekah. Sounds like a done deal, right? Because in part of what this negotiation involves is the fact that this is a righteous act driven and guided by God Almighty. Because I didn't turn to the left or the right, and I brought all the good stuff, and this is what's supposed to happen. This is the hard sell. This is what's going to happen. What do you guys say? And they all say, done deal. All right? So he says, we can't stand in the way of that. So he unloads the camels and gives to the people. So sounds like a done deal, but in the Middle East, it's never over. Verse 54.
And he and the men who were with him ate and drank, and they spent the night there. When they arose in the morning, he said, send me away to my master. Her brother and her mother said, oh, let the young woman...
Her brother and her mother, go ahead.
That's Laban and Bethuel, said, let the young woman remain with us a while, at least 10 days. After that, she may go.
So what do they actually ask after? They after 10 days... What are they after? More money. They want more money. They figure, hey, I got this much. We'll hold her back and we'll go, we're kind of reconsidering. All right, but what is the servant's response? This guy has been hanging out with Abraham, probably one of the most wise men on planet Earth at this time. And this isn't...
Gentile.
Yeah. So, yeah, the son of an idol maker. And so he's one of the smartest people on planet Earth. And he's done a few negotiations, if you read a little earlier in this. This isn't the first time he's done some hard sells and some hard negotiations. And the servant, he's learned well. So, verse 7.
Do not delay me. Since Adonai has prospered my way, send me away that I may go to my master. Oh, and I'll keep going. These are the days of the years of Abraham's life, 175 years. Abraham breathed his last and died in a good old age, an old man and full of years, and was gathered to his people. Isaac and Ishmael, his sons, buried him in the cave of Machpelah, in the field of Ephron, the son of Zohar, the Hittite, east of Mamre, the field that Abraham purchased from the Hittites.
So the servant says... Don't delay me. I'm going to go. At that point, he starts loading up the camels. Now, if the girl doesn't go with him at that moment, where do the goodies go? Back on the camels. The goodies only stay if the girl goes with them. That was the deal. Okay? Girl doesn't go, the goodies go. So they said they're going, Rebekah or the goodies? Rebekah. The goodies. And they send Rebekah. So they send Rebekah on. And at that point, we skip to the end of the parashat because we know that the servant takes Rebekah to Isaac. And they love one another. And he is comforted after his mother's death. And then I'm going to go ahead and, if you wouldn't mind, rereading verse 7 on about the Abraham's death.
These are the days of the years of Abraham's life, 175 years. Abraham breathed his last and died in a good old age, an old man and full of years, and was gathered to his people. Isaac and Ishmael, his sons, buried him in the cave of Machpelah, in the field of Ephron, the son of Zohar, the Hittite, east of Mamre, the field that Abraham purchased from the Hittites.
Notice that the very last words are the field that Abraham purchased from the Hittites. So, this whole parashat is nothing but about how to conduct business and how to conduct business appropriately. You do it in the open and you tell the other person what is on your mind. And if you can come to an agreement, fine. But if you can't, that's okay too. But there are always choices to be made. These are honest transactions made in the open, and they're almost always witnessed by the community. Unfortunately, we live in a world that's dominated by business deals that are made in secret. These deals are intended to enslave humanity and to induce the rule of evil. And there comes the heavy stuff. So I'll start with an easy one. When I was young, I grew up on a farm, and we used a chemical called DDT as an insecticide. Remember DDT? Now all the people, I saw some faces. Look at that face out there. Ooh, the evil DDT. Right? Everybody's cringeworthy. Calm down. And understand that before I get a bunch of hate mail, I'm not a proponent of DDT. But you need to educate yourself. You can't just say that. Because, before we get done, I'm hoping that everybody will understand why. DDT was a very effective and probably the most effective insecticide ever developed in history. It's odorless, tasteless, not harmful to humans, not harmful to wildlife, but it does kill insects. And it was overused from the time that it was developed in 1940 until it was banned in the United States in 1972. It was overused. There were 675,000 tons of the stuff that was blown all over the United States in order to control insect population. And it did. In fact, it was so effective at controlling insect population that it killed off much of the animals that lived on the insects. Does that make sense? And a lot of birds died because they didn't have anything to eat. But it wasn't the evil drug or the evil insecticide that everybody thinks it is. TJ, would you read the Massachusetts article? There's an article that was a study that was published by Massachusetts, or an article published by the University of Massachusetts, and it plays right into what everybody's already thinking. Go.
I was not anticipating this big word, but DDT, or dichlordiphenyl trichloroethane.
Good job.
Is a colorless and tasteless chemical compound developed as an insecticide. And its use was banned because of its role in the increased risk of serious health conditions in humans and animals alike. DDT was at the height of its popularity during the Second World War. During this time, DDT was used to prevent diseases such as malaria and typhus. Though it was an effective insecticide, it was cause for concern when the chemical would also kill beneficial insects as well as birds and fish. Not only did DDT kill birds, but it also caused eggshell thinning in peregrine falcons. This eggshell thinning would make it much more difficult for the falcons' young to be born.
Okay, if you remember, it wasn't just peregrine falcons, and it was all birds of prey. Their eggshells were being thinned by the DDT, and then whenever they would nest on the eggs, it would cause them to fracture, and they wouldn't mature. That is the thing that caused DDT to be banned in the United States. Sounds pretty good, right? The only problem with that is that it's not true. My college professor, and I'm purposefully picking topics that I have first-hand experience with. My college professor in fracture mechanics, when I was in mechanical engineering school, was the lead NTSB researcher hotshot that would get called to the accident sites whenever there was an aircraft crash. And, you know, those guys run around, they'd find where a crack in a rivet on a 747 had separated, you know, and caused the whole stinking thing to fall down. They were very good at what they did. Fracture mechanics requires you to understand what the material is and then how to test it. What he did as part of the research grant that he was given was to go back and review the data that the biologists had used to evaluate the eggshells on for the supposed DDT eggshell thinning research. 100% of it, not 90, not 98%, but 100% of it was baloney. 100% of it was baloney. Baloney. When you take an eggshell or a piece of metal or any ceramic or non-ceramic material, if you hit it hard and fast, it'll fracture or it'll break at a lower yield than if you push it really, really slow. If it's a brittle substance, if you hit it with something blunt, it will break at a higher strength than with something pointed. There was no baseline ever used by any of the researchers in the way that they tested the eggshells. They just started hitting it harder and faster until they found that the eggshells were thinning, and that's what they based their research on. And when he discovered this, they had many, 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 there's actually, who knows, at the time, this was in the early 90s, there were thousands of these birds that were still in freezers. So they pulled them out of the freezers, and the biologists went to taking flesh samples on them, found that all of them had, at that time, a flu virus that was specifically attacking the birds of prey population. It was an avian bird flu virus, and it ran its course, and the bird population came back. It had nothing to do with DDT. DDT is still recognized as one of the most effective insecticides on the planet, but it was intentionally vilified. Anybody want to guess why? Patents. It was all about money. Because DDT was cheap. That's part of the reason there were 675,000 tons of the stuff used, because it was cheap. And Monsanto just happened... Monsanto just happened to have all the replacement insecticides, much more expensive, much, 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 much more toxic, much more harmful to the environment, and much more profitable. But you shouldn't take offense, because it was just business. Anybody remember the ozone hole? What happened to the ozone hole? Come on, somebody. Yeah, it all knitted itself together, and then it became a hole again, knitted itself together. What happened to the ozone hole? The ozone hole was a hoax. When I say hoax, I mean hoax in spades. I'm a mechanical engineer, and the cause of the ozone hole, according to the researchers, was CFC emissions in the atmosphere. The chlorofluorocarbons were reacting with the ozone, the O3, layer, and that is our UV protection. And if we didn't eliminate the emissions of ozone emitting gases such all CFCs, chlorofluorocarbons, we were all going to die. Okay, remember that? Every ASHRAE convention that was held in the United States had slews of engineers, physicists, and researchers stand at podiums just like this and tell the public, that's a bunch of baloney. The reason that they wanted the CFCs banned is because DuPont's patents on R22 and R12 refrigerant, which, by the way, like DDT, are the most efficient refrigerants that have ever been developed. They take less energy and convert more heat, delta T, in the phase change process than anything that's been developed since then. But their patents were running out, which means that they could be cheaply produced worldwide. And they couldn't have that because that means that they would lose their market share. So, hired a bunch of researchers, paid them big grant monies, and then created the ozone hole hoax. This is a true story, people, and everybody in my industry knows it. But we're a small industry, and we don't control the media. No offense, it's just business. The replacement refrigerants that were used are now, let me back up, R22 and R12 are called inert gas. What's an inert gas? It means it's harmless. It doesn't react to anything. You can breathe it, you can wash it, you can dump it on the ground, it just evaporates. But the replacement refrigerants are toxic, explosive in most cases. In fact, made a good bunch of money for many of us and still does for me to this day, because as we change out some of the old chillers and chiller plants and so on that still have these refrigerants in them, and we put in R134A and these kinds of things, I get to build walls between the boiler plant and the chiller plant and duct the boilers and so on and so forth in order to meet code, because if I don't and the chiller leaks, it'll go over to the boiler, get sucked into the intake, and blow the whole thing to smithereens. Amazing, right? But you shouldn't worry. Just business. John, you got a video for me, the first one? I think you can play that for us. While he's teeing it up, the person that you're going to hear speak is a guy named Fletcher Prouty. Anybody know who Fletcher Prouty is? He's been around for decades. He started out in the 70s Well, he had a lot of different hats, but go ahead and play.
Well, you mentioned in one of your last talks that petroleum wasn't what we thought it was, that it wasn't a fossil fuel, that it didn't come from fossil animal.
Yeah.
Is it just a mineral? Is it a mineral like any other mineral? What's the origin of
petroleum? You see, when they first found petroleum, because they were beginning to make motors and needed on axles of wheels on railroad trains and all that sort of thing, and remember, trains started in the beginning of the 19th century, then oil went from just a lubricant to a fuel, and it made it valuable. And Rockefeller happened to be the smartest man in the business at the time. But he made most of his money, or much of it, off the transport of the petroleum as well as selling it. But one thing they realized was, putting a price on oil is like putting a price on a pail of water. You know, no initial cost. It's in the ground, and in those days they were some of it almost what you'd call surface mining the oil. They didn't go down deep. So in order to get the price up, they hit on the idea that they would have to make it appear to be scarce. After we take the next few barrels out, we're probably going to have to close as well, you know, that kind of thing. Well, a very fortuitous event. In 1892, there was a convention in Geneva of scientists to determine what organic substances are. Well, the definition of organic is a substance with hydrogen, oxygen, and carbon. And so it's usually a living substance, a tree. You analyze a dead tree, hydrogen, carbon, and oxygen, and grass, and so on. Living things, animals, we are hydrogen, oxygen, and carbon. So at this Geneva Convention, Rockefeller took advantage of sending some scientists over who said, oil, petroleum, is hydrogen, oxygen, and carbon. Therefore, it must be derived from the spoiling, the rotting of formerly living matter. And playing the game properly, when this scientific convention was over, they defined oil as the residue from formerly living matter. Well, that makes it a fossil fuel. I don't know why they decided to use the word fossil, but it says formerly living matter, it's fossil. Well, of course, today, and another thing we should know is that there has never been a fossil, a real fossil found below 16,000 feet. And you can't argue at 16,000 is a level line because someplace the ground sinks and so on, but 16 is what the scientists say, 16,000. We mine oil, or we drill for oil, at 30,000, 33,000, 28,000 every day of the week. So right there, we rule it out that it isn't fossil fuel. It's called fossil fuel for the minds of the public to feel that it is an asset that is running out, being depleted. We talk about depletion allowance, which is a lot of, you know. And actually, if you know the world's oil supply, you know that it is not going to run out for an awfully long time. It is the second most prevalent liquid on Earth. And we haven't begun to.
Okay, second most prevalent liquid. It's like putting a price on a pail of water. It's ubiquitous. It's everywhere. And it's not rare. Do you believe that? You should, because it happens to be true. Even Noah used tar, pitch, inside and out. He didn't get that from a tree. He got that out of tar pit. It's throughout the Bible, whenever Abraham had a war with went to war with the other kings, he scared them into a bunch of tar pits, and they sank into this. This was surface mining oil. This stuff's everywhere. And guess what? It was put here by God for our use. Okay? Now, I wanted to test this because I don't just take things anymore at face value. And most of the people being Bereans and Messianic, that automatically means you don't take things at face value because you came out of a lie and you don't want to jump into another lie when you left your whatever Christian, Catholic, whatever Catholic, whatever the roots are. So I have a set of Encyclopedia Britannica in my office. Actually, I have two sets. One of them's from 1905. Fold it down, open it up. Guess what petroleum is? It's a mineral. Okay. I went over and I got the 1943 set out, and I pulled it open, and guess what it still is? Still a mineral. In 1943, oil is still a mineral, but it does say that research funded by Rockefeller indicates that it is a fossil fuel created from formerly living matter. And if true, I meant to bring them in with me, actually, and just read it word for word. The language is a lot better than mine, but if true, it would transform these pockets of a natural occurring ubiquitous resource. And here's the term, it will transform them into pockets of commerce. In other words, it'll transform that oil that's just ubiquitous into money. Not a big deal, just business. When I'm a mechanical engineer, and we design buildings. And I was doing a commissioning effort at the Orthopedics Institute on Hull Road. Many of you know UF Orthopedics Building when it was completed. And commissioning is when you go in and you test the equipment, the HVAC and the other systems in the building, and make sure that they work as they were designed, as they were intended. Now, before I do the commissioning, there's this group that comes in, a contractor that comes in, and he performs what's called a test, adjust, and balance of all the systems. Test and balance, we call it for short. And in that process, he sets the airflows in the auditoriums and in the classrooms, and there's usually a reheat coil of some sort so that during the winter time you can control the temperature. It'll get warmer in here and cooler and so on and so forth. And in this case, the reheat was heating hot water piped to the individual terminal boxes. We call them terminal boxes, but it's the thing that discharges the air, into the space. So while I'm doing the test and balance, doing the commissioning, I have to have the copy of the test and balance because I'm trying to verify and validate that it works, the system works. I have the man's, the test and balance contractor's, handwritten copy in my hands. And I ask the controls contractor, open the heating hot water valve on the BAV box, the terminal box, so that I can see that the heat works. He does, nothing happens. Temperature stays cold. So I get a ladder, push up the ceiling tile. The valves to the heating hot water reheat coil are closed. Didn't think much of it until I opened the valves and I heard the air bubble out of the coil and the water enter the coil for the very first time. I looked across the ceiling above the ceiling tile and I could see that all the valves were closed. And I asked the mechanical contractor, have they ever been open? He's sitting there with a smirk on his face. He goes, nope. So, test and balance report, what is it? It's a fake, okay? He did that on the hood of his truck. It was a fake. Even if he tested some of the other stuff, which I don't believe he did, what can I assume, since all of those VAV boxes, what can I assume about the rest of the report? It's all bogus. It's all bogus. Now, bear that in mind whenever you're trying to do a little critical thinking about the world around you. Let's do the COVID-19 one. That one's a fun one. John spoke on this a couple of weeks ago. Yet people continue to take the solution, I like to call it, wear masks and isolate themselves. Okay? I design BSL-4 laboratories, not even 3. BSL-3 is heavy containment. 4 is where they deal with Ebola and stuff that will, you know, if it touches you, you're a dead person. And in order to be able to build those kinds of laboratories, I have to know how to be able to filter out the media, the cooties. If I don't know how to contain or control a virus, I can't very well design the laboratory that it's going to be developed in. Those masks you're wearing? Completely useless. It's like throwing sand through hog wire. Now, there are some masks that do work. An N9s. Those, but they don't work on you. You put those on the patient that's sick. You don't put those on you. But I'm not going to convince anybody. You're going to have to be convinced of your own self. And most people don't want to hear any of this stuff because it messes with their security. I spoke to a vice president in one of the major hospitals one day, and we were just after a meeting, we were just having casual conversation. And I wanted to know, because I had made a presentation on how to fix one of their sick buildings, and if they did what I told them to do, they could repair the building, put new air conditioning equipment in the building, and the energy savings alone would pay for itself in 2 years. Now, that's an incredible payback in anybody's economy. And he laughed at me. He goes, yeah, I hear you, Sam. I hear you. But I can buy an MRI for the same price, and it pays back in 6 months. It's just business. So I go, oh, now I know I'm talking to a businessman. So what is the most profitable thing in your hospital? What's the most profitable department in your hospital? Okay. Radiology is only a subset of that department. I thought it was orthopedics. No, it's radiology, but it's not radiology. Because radiology is only a piece of it. It's oncology. Cancer. Wow. Did you know that 98% of the health care that is provided in a person's life is provided in the last 2 months of his life, and it's almost always cancer? So they start, and he explained it to me. I mean, he was just very matter of fact. It wasn't like he kind of had a wry smile while he was talking, but he goes, oh, cancer's great, you know. You come in, got a little spot, his general physician sees you, got a little spot. Well, we need to send you over here to this other guy. The guy looks at you, yep, you got a spot. We need to send you off for a battery of tests. He does a little test and some skin samples. Well, we need to get you into radiology. We need to get you an MRI and a CT scan and a CAT scan and another scan and some more testing, and then we're going to find out where it is. Once we figured out where it is, we're going to send you to another specialist, and it's never ending, never ending, and then the treatment starts. No offense, just business. And just in case I haven't destroyed anyone's idols, I'll destroy one of mine. Next one, John.
This Neil, radio check. Neil, this is Houston, loud and clear. Break, break, buzz, this is Houston. Radio check and verify TV circuit breaker in.
Roger, TV circuit breaker's in. Base 5 clear.
Roger. And we're getting a picture on the TV.
You got a good picture, huh?
There's a great deal of contrast in it, and currently it's upside down on our monitor, but we can make out a fair amount of detail.
Okay, would you verify the position the opening I ought to have on the camera?
Stand by.
There's that foot coming down.
There he is. Yeah. There's a foot coming down the steps.
Okay, Neil, we can see you coming down the ladder now.
Okay, I just checked getting back up to that first step. It's not even collapsed too far, but it's adequate to get back up.
Roger, we copy.
Pretty good little jump.
So there's a foot on the moon, stepping down on the moon. If he's testing that first step, he must be stepping down on the moon at this point.
Buzz, this is Houston. F2, 1/160th second for shadow photography on the sequence camera.
Okay. I'm at the foot of the ladder. The limb footbeds are only depressed in the surface about 1 or 2 inches, although the surface appears to be very, very fine-grained as you get close to it. It's almost like a powder. Ground mass is very fine.
Boy, look at those pictures. Wow. It's a little shadowy, but he said he expected that in the shadow of the lunar module. Armstrong is on the moon.
Yeah,
Neil Armstrong, 38-year-old American, standing on the surface of the moon on this July 20th, 1969.
That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
I think that was Neil's quote. I didn't understand it.
No, one small step for man, but I didn't get the second phrase. Some one of our monitors here at our space headquarters is able to hear that. We'd like to know what it was.
The surface is fine and powdery. I can pick it up loosely with my toe. It does adhere in fine layers, like powdered charcoal, to the and
sides
of my boot.
His quote was, that's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
I can see the footprints of my boots and the treads in the fine sandy particles.
Okay, I just got to stop. That I was waked up. I was woken up by my parents to watch that. It was the defining moment of my life at the time. I wouldn't walk across the street to see a sports star or an actor. My heroes were astronauts. Buzz Aldrin was supposedly in the lunar module, and Neil Armstrong was the one out.
I remember my parents waking up.
But Buzz was second. So, remember the test and balance story when you watch the next clip.
Be presumptuous Buzz. Here. I can call you Buzz.
Buzz.
Okay.
That's a legal name, passport,
okay.
Driver's license.
And I am Uncle Coney tonight.
Uncle Coney.
Let's talk about this because this is fascinating. I remember very clearly, I think anybody who was alive at the time does. I remember my parents waking me up and we went down and we watched you guys land on the moon.
No,
which
you didn't.
Was,
no, you didn't.
What?
Because there wasn't any television. There wasn't anybody taking a picture. You watched animation. See, you associated what you saw with.
I have very hazy memories. Well, what we saw was we all were gathered around
the
old curved top radio and listened.
Talking about how many feet we were going to the left and right, and then I said contact light, engine stop.
It was
exciting. A few other things, and then Neil said, "Houston, Tranquility Base, the Eagle has landed." How about that?
That was very exciting.
Not a bad line.
Wow. Yeah,
not a bad line.
So were you self-conscious about
just
all the...
Just stop this nonsense. Not a bad line. It was all an act. Okay? Yeah, because there's a room full of Bereans. There's some of you that get it and some of you that have done the research and that know. But there's others, 9/11... many others that are, if you're going to tell, and many of the people that have perpetrated these lies against us, I'll say, if you're going to tell a lie, make sure you make it a big one. But the greatest deception of all has been in the works for years. And this one might take a little time to set up because it's the one that is going to be used to usher in the New World Order. What is it? Global climate change, not this global climate change. That's the one that we gotta watch out for. But the problem with all of that situation is, thank you, John, for teeing it up, is that carbon has been identified as the villain. If carbon isn't controlled, what's going to happen? Well, it's going to warm the planet to the point that all life on Earth is going to die. We have to respond now or we're all going to die. Problem with that is that 72% of the greenhouse gases that contained in the atmosphere is what?
Water.
It's water. Water, and it's called clouds, too, because we lump them together, but the climatologists separate them into two separate categories, water and clouds, somewhere between 70 and 72%. Al Gore didn't lie during his inconvenient truth. He said, if you ignore water vapor, then carbon makes up 50% of the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. He's right. He's absolutely right. If you ignore 70%, then the other 28%, half of that, is carbon. And really? Well, there's a problem with carbon, and that is that if you, like the gentleman here, in fact, just play the video. I know. We'll play this for a while. Then we've been at
In the spring of 2015, I went to Princeton University to interview Professor William Happer. When I interviewed him, I was aware that he was a CO2 and its impact on climate contrarian. Mr. Happer points out carbon dioxide is an important trace gas and an integral part of the carbon cycle, a biogeochemical cycle in which carbon is exchanged between the oceans, soil, rocks, and the biosphere. Virtually all of life on the planet requires CO2 concentrations to be above 150 parts per million. The concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere over the past 500 million years has been as high as 4,000 parts per million and as low as 180 parts per million. Since 1880, when CO2 was measured at Mauna Loa in Hawaii, levels have risen from 280 parts per million to 413 parts per million as of April 2019. Mr. Happer, as you will hear, says the impact of CO2 on temperature rise has already taken effect, and he points to the logarithmic scale, which is a non-linear scale often used to analyze a large range of quantities. According to Mr. Happer, it would take another 400 parts per million to affect temperature by one additional degree. Mr. Happer is also aware of the folly of predictions. And he, like Freeman Dyson, points to the inability of models to accurately predict climate outcomes. Then add in the length of day, which changes by milliseconds, transferring massive amounts of energy, mostly into the oceans, causing oscillations that, according to climatologist Judith Curry, are not considered in current climate models. It begs the question, is the science of climate really settled? Can it ever be? Now, Mr. Happer's position on climate, his scientific credentials, and his role in the Trump administration have made him a very large target. He is a physicist who specialized in the study of atomic physics, optics, and spectroscopy. He is the Cirrus Fogg Brackett Professor of Physics, and he is the Davison Germer Prize winner in atomic or surface physics. He is not, nor could he be, a climate scientist, because that designation is so new that UCLA, for example, only just launched a degree program in 2018. Since this interview, Greenpeace outed him in a sting operation, and President Donald Trump recruited Professor Happer to be a member of a presidential committee on climate security. However, in September of 2019, the unflinching Mr. Happer quit. According to Science Magazine, well, Happer may have been unflinching, Trump's White House isn't. So on September the 13th, 2019, Mr. Happer resigned. Professor Happer, as you will see in this interview, firmly believes the impact of CO2 has been misrepresented.
Conversations That Matter is a partner.
So we can portable heater is. We could go ahead and play it. It's about 30 minutes long. I'm going to go ahead and give it to. I'll give it to Rabbi for distribution. It's worth your listen. And if you didn't get it, Dr. Happer has, you know, he knows his stuff, and he's not making stuff up, and he's among a minority but significant portion of the science community who is willing to speak the truth. If you're not willing to speak the truth, you get canceled. But a few simple facts about CO2 that you all ought to know, and he discusses this in the video, is that once you applying CO2 to global heating is similar to painting a barn red. You put the first coat of paint on, it's only a little bit red. Put the second coat of paint on, it's pretty stinking red. Put the third coat of paint on, it's as red as it's going to get. You can put as many coats of paint on as you want to after that, and it's not going to change the color of the building. We've already taken the impact of the CO2 increase in the atmosphere as far as the temperature of the Earth goes, keep increasing it, and the temperature of the Earth is essentially unaffected. The other thing that is important to know about CO2 is it's the basic building block of all life. Anything below 150, and we all die. Let me say that again. If it's below 150, we all die because plants can't sustain on a CO2 level below 150. They will die. And it's been as low as 180. We are just barely crawling out of what would be called a CO2 drought. And if you don't believe it, look at the production of the world and the deserts of the world over the past few years. The fact that the earth is greening up currently has everything to do with the increase in the CO2. And if you took note of what he says, it's been as high, 4,000 parts per billion. 4,000. We're 413. And it's been as high as 4,000. The net impact on the world economy would be a net negative because the increase in production of food would be in the billions worldwide. So why is CO2 such a big topic? It's all about business. You can't control water vapor and clouds, but you can control people's carbon emissions, and you can charge for it. All of these things have a spiritual overtone. In fact, the Pope has convened an ecumenical organization of all of the religions of the world to meet at Mount Sinai. Why? Anybody up on this? New Ten Commandments. They're going to issue a new set of Ten Commandments on climate responsibility and climate change. I'm not going to read it to you, but here is the National Catholic Reporter, and I'm just going to read one paragraph about how their position. This will give you a sense of what people's position are on this worldwide. Early in the morning, climate activists smashed mock tablets of stone atop Mount Sinai in reaction to world leaders' failure to follow through on their commitment to mitigate the and adapt to climate change. The act references the story in Exodus 32 when, after descending Mount Sinai, an angry Moses smashed the Ten Commandments in protest against the Israelites for worshiping other gods. What are these people actually worshiping? They're worshiping the climate god. The reality of it is CO2 is good for this environment. Wow. Yep, I said it. It's actually good for us. The more CO2 we would emit into this atmosphere, go out there and crank your car and rev it up, man, because it's good for us. It is. It will green this planet up and end world hunger. Not a joke. But it's just business. The reality of it is that that is what is going to usher in the new world order. Because that what the WEF, the UN, and our nation has signed on for. It's a global part of the global reset. The intent is to consolidate power in the hands of a few wealthy people and corporations. You got to understand that being in the United States, we live in a society that has a middle class. Outside of Israel, when it entered the land, there's really been no other society on the planet Earth until the United States came along that had a middle class. What was the governmental structure before that? Monarchy. It was the king, a few wealthy, and peasants, slaves. That's it. No middle class. Peasants, wealthy people. They want to reestablish peasants and wealthy people in the world. They don't want the middle class. The middle class is an anathema to them. This is why I wanted to hustle through this, and you're all kind of just going to have to sit, I guess, now, because now we're in the meat of it. This goes to this whole business about understanding what business is actually doing is an exercise in truth and understanding. Everything you've been told about just about everything is a lie, because it's been motivated by other forces. It's been motivated by agendas, mostly greed and power, almost always greed and power. It comes down to, how do we know what we know? How do we know what we know? There's three ways we know what we know. Personal experience. I drop this on my foot, it hurts. I start a fire and I put my hand in it, it burns. This thing's heavy, this thing's light. That's how we know what we know. Personal experience. Second one is revelation. Revelation. What is revelation? Divine authority. Divinely inspired. It's your Bible. Your Bible is revelation. That's how we know the second thing. The third thing of how we know what we know is appeal to authority. Appeal to authority. That's what somebody does when they reference somebody else's documentation. That's what you do when you listen to the news, and then you tell somebody else about the news. You know what just happened in Arizona? Talk to you. Where, Dan? Where'd you go? You know what just happened in Peru? Peru, I told you about it. An emergency vehicle pulled out in front of an aircraft landing and killed all the people in the. Okay, how do I know that? Appeal to authority. I was told by another source. Okay, now, was I there? No. Did I read it in the Bible? No. So I'm taking somebody else's word for it. Okay? Now, if I'm taking somebody else's word for it, and we've just demonstrated that just about everything you get told is a lie, how many of you are checking up on this stuff? Or how many of you are just taking it for granted? Whenever COVID came along, my former, before John actually took the position, office manager came in before she retired. COVID is a long eater. We're all going to die. You need to close this office, blah, blah, blah. I said, go home, Diane. You're poisoning my office. You don't understand. You don't believe it, but it's a long eater. I mean, that's the level. And she did no checking. Just believed what she was told. And now the truth is coming out about that stuff, and we know better. But we should have known better back then. But we were willing to just take it at face value. What's happened to us is that we're told that personal experience can't be trusted. You can't trust your senses. Your senses can be fooled. You can be tricked. So your senses are no good. And forget about revelation. That's just superstition, right? The only thing that you can reliably trust is what I tell you. Appeal to authority. We need to reverse that. We should experience for ourselves and validate for ourselves. We should trust our Bible. We should trust our revelation. We should not appeal to authority for our understanding of truth. The problem with following the science is that science has an agenda. It always does, and it always has. The problem with science is that it rarely follows the scientific process. Sometimes, most of the time, engineering follows the scientific process, but few others, including, and most specifically, the medical profession and anything having to do with humanity. Why does that happen? Because nearly all funding is paid for by large corporations. Just like the DDT scam, Monsanto funded the testing of the eggshells, and the people found what they were supposed to find. Usually, the researchers have incentives, or they're incentivized, to find what they're being paid for on the promise of getting more funding. for more work. And often, as TJ pointed out to me last night, researchers will even admit that their testing processes is flawed and then go on to present the information anyway. See, the goal of a PhD when you're a doctoral candidate isn't to establish truth necessarily, and it's not necessarily to contribute to humanity's understanding of knowledge. What is the goal of a doctoral student? To get a doctorate. It's not to establish truth. You don't care. You want a PhD. You're spending a lot of money for that stinking thing. There's also interdepartmental pressures that come from this activity. And you're also, there's usually an agenda behind your department anyway. If your department happens to be environmental sciences, for example, you must find that man is bad, nature is good, and left to itself, nature will prevail. Problem with that is, it's a lie. As a former farmer, I can tell you Mother Nature is a lousy steward of herself. TJ, Genesis 1, verse 26.
Then God said, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the heavens, and over the livestock, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God he created him. Male and female he created them. And God blessed them. And God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth." The Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to work it and keep it.
Ooh, what's man's purpose in this situation? We're supposed to have dominion over the world and we're supposed to keep it. We're not supposed to sit in our house and just let it overgrow. That's actually just the opposite of what we're supposed to do. But listen to the climate gurus and they'll tell you that it's supposed to be hands off. Has anybody ever looked at the 2021 agenda or the map of the United States? Google it up. 90% of the United States will be wilderness area, according to the WEF 2021 agenda, which is also intended to depopulate the earth by 2030, reduce it from almost 8 billion that we are now, short 8 billion, 7.8 million billion people, down to how many? Anybody know? 3.5 million. More than half by 2030. 8 years from now, we're supposed to reduce the population by more than half. How are you going to do that? You got to kill them. Yeah, they don't die off that fast. And they don't just stop having kids unless you sterilize them or use other nefarious means. What you got to understand, congregation, is that the world, it's all business. And this entire world is being controlled by evil forces. Since Genesis 11, the entire world, post-flood, Genesis 11 is Tower of Babel. Remember the Tower of Babel? The humanity rebelled against God, formed a group to make a name for themselves. If you read some extra biblical texts, the real purpose of the Tower of Babel was so that they could break into heaven, set up Nimrod as king, and kill God. That was the goal. Set up Nimrod as God, kill God, and take over. That was the original intent of the Genesis 11 experiment, if you want to call it that. Deuteronomy 32:8 was, for me, the thing that unlocked the whole Bible. And it has to do with that event. When the Most High gave the nations their inheritance, everybody should be taking out their Bible right now because some of you need to make a correction in it, okay? The language needs to be corrected, and I'll tell you where it is. Because it was sub, it was, anyway, never, I'll stop. When the Most High, we could pull that one of those out there and read it, and it'll be right. When the Most High gave the nations their inheritance, when mankind, when he divided mankind, he fixed the borders of the people according to the number of the sons of God. Okay, some of your translations say the number of the sons of Israel. Israel. That's not correct. And I can prove it to you, but that's maybe take another time, but I'll at least put it out here. It was fixed by the number of the sons of God. Who are the sons of God? Angelic hosts that have been assigned regions to rule. As they're angelic beings that have been assigned regions to rule. But God's portion is Jacob, is his people, Jacob his allotted. Okay? What that verse says is that at the Tower of Babel, God took mankind and split it all over the earth. And everybody has a fixed border. This guy's in charge of this region, this guy's in charge of this region, this guy's in charge of this region, and the people that live there, and the people that live there, and the people that live there, they're his people. They rule over them. But God chose one, and he chose Abraham and his descendants, and he says, with Abraham, I'm going to kick all y'all's behind. Let's get it on. That's literally what that says. Once you understand that, it gets a little more easy to understand why the earth and all of the information that you give may often be tainted. God presides over a divine council of angelic beings. Most of Scripture, if you go back and read it now, understanding this, whenever God says he's sitting in his council and he's speaking to the angelic beings and says, how long are you guys going to judge unjustly? How long are you going to continue to do what you're doing? Why aren't you doing what I told you to do? Why aren't you judging the world like I instructed you to do? And because of that, you will die like men. Okay? He's not talking to men. He's talking to the angelic hosts that are in charge of this world. Got to figure out where I'm at. TJ. Luke 17:22.
And he said to the disciples, the days are coming when you will desire to see one of the days of the Son of Man, and you will not see it. And they will say to you, look there, or look here. Do not go out or follow them. For as the lightning flashes and lights up the sky from one side to the other, so will the Son of Man be in this day. But first he must suffer many things and be rejected by this generation. Just as it was in the days of Noah, so it will be in the days of the Son of Man.
Okay, so what was it like in the days of Noah? Anybody know? Genesis 6:11, TJ.
Now the earth was corrupt in God's sight, and the earth was filled with violence. And God saw the earth, and behold, it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way on earth.
Okay. All it says that earth was corrupt in the sight of God. Now, it was corrupt in two ways. It's corrupt in its flesh and in its ways. In other words, let me change that up a little bit. We were corrupt in our flesh and in our business dealings, the way we conducted business with one another. We were corrupt. It was corrupt back then, and in the days of in this coming of the Son of Man, when Yeshua returns, it's going to be like that again. We're going to be corrupt in our flesh, and we're going to be corrupt in the ways that we conduct ourselves with one another. John 14:6, please.
Jesus said to him, I am the way, the truth, and the life. Then in Psalm 20, verse 7, it says, some trust in chariots and some in horses, but we trust in the name of the Lord our God.
Keep going.
Mm-hmm. And in Psalm 31, verse 11, it says, because of all my adversaries, I have become a reproach, especially to my neighbors, and an object of dread to my acquaintances. Those who see me in the street flee from me. I have been forgotten like one who is dead. I have become like a broken vessel. For I hear the whispering of many, terror on every side, as they scheme together against me, as they plot to take my life.
Okay, hold it for a second. One of the things that we're going to have to determine in our lives is who we're going to trust. Are we going to trust the Lord, or are we going to trust man? Man has already proven that he's going to lie to us. That's what we've been talking about this whole time. But if we choose God's way, it isn't going to be an easy road. Verse 14.
But I trust in you, O Lord, I say. You are my God. Many times are in your hand. Rescue me from the hand of my enemies and from my persecutors. Make your face shine on your servant. Save me in your steadfast love. O God, let me not be put to shame, for I call upon you. Let the wicked be put to shame. Let them go silently to Sheol. Let the lying lips be mute, which speak insolently against the righteous in pride and contempt.
Psalm 62:1.
For God alone my soul waits in silence. From him comes my salvation. He alone is my rock and my salvation, my fortress. I shall not be greatly shaken. How long will all of you attack a man to batter him like a leaning wall, a tottering fence? They only plan to thrust him down from his high position. They take pleasure in falsehood. They bless with their mouths, but inwardly they curse. Selah. For God alone, O my soul, wait in silence, for my hope is with him. He only is my rock and my salvation, my fortress. I shall not be shaken. On God rests my salvation and my glory. My mighty rock, my refuge is God. Trust in him at all times, O people. Pour out your heart before him. God is a refuge for us. Selah.
So how are we supposed to conduct business? I think it's best summed up in Ecclesiastes 12. I'll start at verse 9, but it's the last verse that actually matters. Besides being wise, the preacher also taught the people knowledge, weighing and studying and arranging many proverbs with great care. The preacher sought to find words of delight, and uprightly he wrote his words of truth. The words of the wise are like goads, and like nails firmly fixed are the collected sayings. They are given by the one shepherd. My son, beware of anything beyond these. And here it is. Making of books, there is no end, and of much study, wearying the flesh. The end of the matter, all has been heard. Fear God and keep his commands, for this is the whole duty of man. Shabbat shalom.